Order the House Committee on Judiciary, Civil Law, and welcome everybody today. We've got some members with us today. What I would like to do is open a public hearing briefly on Senate Bill 449 and in order for Senator Leonard to come on up and offer his testimony and your wife's testimony. I'm sorry, 846. I'll fix that in just a second here. We'll start with that, and then we'll close that hearing, because I think by then Senator Bryant will be down, and we have Representative Morissette in to testify on that one, too. Oh, that's right. Jeez, I was just down in the Senate. Yeah, thanks. Representative Leonard. Well, let's open up a hearing on Senate Bill 846, and welcome Representative Leonard to our gathering.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My colleagues get settled here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Randy Leonard. I am the state representative from District 21 in Southeast Portland. And I'm here today actually just to introduce those that have come from Portland today to appear and testify in support of Senate Bill 846. But I would just like to say that this bill actually provides for some protection for firefighters and police officers who, for an example, may go through a debriefing over some stressful incident or stress-inducing incident that they've been involved in the line of work that firefighters and police officers do. And this bill provides some protection for that, some of that information that may be shared in that debriefing as confidential. As you can imagine, firefighters and police officers sometimes health-wise are their own worst enemies. We don't always do the things necessary to keep ourselves healthy mentally after dealing with some of the issues that occur. So Senate Bill 846 was created to deal with that problem. And I would like to introduce on my far right Tom Chamberlain, who is president of the Portland Firefighters Association, succeeded me in that role a year and a half ago, and is also a firefighter with the Portland Fire Bureau and assigned to deal with firefighters that are disabled. And to my immediate left is Robert King, who is a police officer with the Portland Police Bureau and has that same kind of role in the police bureau. And to my immediate right is Julie Leonard, who is my spouse, who oversees this program for Portland Fire and Police. And she asked me to introduce her this morning. I said, well, maybe we better look and see who's going to be on the committee before I do that. Mm-hmm. And obviously I felt comfortable coming here. This one I probably can go to, and introduce you probably won't hurt. So, Mr. Chair, Julie Leonard, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding Senate Bill 846. And the subject of peer support confidentiality. For the record, my name is Julianne Leonard. I'm the Disability Claims Manager for the Portland Fire and Police Disability and Retirement Fund, and I also oversee the employee assistance programs of both the Portland Police Bureau and the Portland Bureau of Fire, Rescue, and Emergency Services. On behalf of all three of these organizations, I would like to voice my strong support for Senate Bill 846, and the concept of peer support confidentiality. Confidentiality is the cornerstone of any good employee assistance program. Without a strong reputation for confidentiality and adequate safeguards against the violation of confidentiality, the very people who most need our help will not seek our assistance. The employee assistance programs of the Portland Police and Fire Bureaus utilize peer support counseling under a wide variety of circumstances. The culture of public safety work particularly lends itself to peer support counseling. as many police officers and firefighters feel more comfortable talking to someone who comes to the conversation with an experience-based understanding of what the work entails. A prime example of how effective peer support counseling can be is the Portland Police Bureau's Traumatic Incident Committee, referred to as the TIC team. The TIC team responds to all officer-involved shootings, providing a supportive presence, a listening ear, educational information about critical incident stress reactions, referrals to mental health professionals, and other supportive follow-up to the officers involved in these deadly force incidents. Every member of the TIC team has been involved in his or her own deadly force incident, and so understands in a very personal way the profound effect this experience can have on its participants. The bond that is created between the TIC team member and the officer being counseled just because of that shared experience can provide the officer with an invaluable sense of relief and comfort, along with information and referrals that will help carry him or her through this very difficult experience in the healthiest way possible. Shootings, of course, are only one of the traumatic events law enforcement officers are exposed to in the course of their work. Think of the police officer with small children of his own at home, responding to a SID's death, or taking an abused child covered with bruises and scars into protective custody. Think about the police officer who arrives on a scene just in time to witness a teen jump to her death from a downtown bridge. Police officers regularly witness the tragedy of suicide, of gang violence, of accidental death, of SID's death, serious and fatal accidents. They see the devastation of domestic violence, child abuse, elder abuse, and the list can go on and on. And police officers are not the only emergency services providers who respond to these events. Firefighters do too, often as the first medical responders on a scene. Firefighters are regularly exposed to trauma and are just as likely to be mentally and emotionally injured by their experiences as are police officers. Consider these examples, some of which you will recognize from recent months. When a 16-year-old girl took an accidental shotgun blast to her face recently, it was firefighter paramedics who attended to her, who stabilized her, who stayed with her and talked to her, looking down on this young girl with nothing but blood and devastation where her face used to be. When a specialized trench rescue team recently responded to a young man trapped face down in a ditch that had caved in, the ditch was determined to be too unstable to enter, so firefighters had to stand by helplessly and powerless as the distraught and hysterical father blamed them for the death of his son. When firefighters responded to the scene of a late-night car wreck, one firefighter attempted to locate the victims, who turned out to be two teenage girls in the front seat of the car. Confused at first when he couldn't figure out which way they were facing, he realized with horror as he pulled their bodies from the wrecked car that both young girls had been decapitated in the accident. And incidentally, the firefighter who told me that story was relaying to me all the times he could remember being completely drenched in blood because he had recently been diagnosed with a blood-borne disease called hepatitis C. Through the employee assistance programs of the Portland Fire and Police Bureaus, we are attempting to ensure that no one who faces those kind of traumas is ever left to deal with them on their own again. When a critical incident occurs, we assign peer support counselors, we make referrals to mental health professionals, we conduct critical incident stress debriefings, all in an attempt to give police officers and firefighters the opportunities they deserve to recover from these experiences, to begin the process of healing, and to stay healthy emotionally so that they can continue to do the heroic work they do so well. But this brings me back to my first point. We cannot accomplish our mission of providing effective employee assistance to police officers or firefighters unless we can assure people that the services we provide are confidential. Our job, what we do, is to support the people who go out every day to protect us, to protect our homes, and to keep us safe. But some of the people who need our help are standing just outside our door, not sure whether it's safe to come in, because right now we cannot guarantee the confidentiality of our services. This bill would help us open our door to the police officers and firefighters who need help because of their jobs. In a responsible way, setting appropriate limits, Senate Bill 846 ensures that the kind of helping work we do can be done confidentially. I urge your support of Senate Bill 846.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do now is recess this hearing. We have Senator Bryant and Representative Morissette who are here, and then we'll bring you back up. So we'll take their testimony and bring you back up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So we'll recess the hearing on Senate Bill 846 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 449, and welcome Senator Bryant and Representative Morissette.
Good afternoon, and thank you for scheduling this. I'm Neil Bryant, and I'm the senator from District 27, Central Oregon. And today I'm proud to sponsor Senate Bill 449, which comes to you from the Safe Schools Alliance of Central Oregon. This alliance was formed after the shooting at Thurston, and they do a lot of good things in the community, the school community, to try and determine and assess students who might have some risk to themselves or others. And in the process of putting this group together, and exchanging information, that's between the sheriff's office and the courts and the juvenile authority and the DA and the school districts, they discovered that they ran into some statutory roadblocks in exchanging information. And this bill corrects that. It also operates within the federal act dealing with student privacy rights. I think passed the Senate with virtually no opposition. I don't remember if there was any. They have a few technical changes on it, but it will help not only the school districts in my district, but school districts everywhere that want to have one of these alliances.
Yes, Representative Warbler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I first want to say that I think what Deschutes County is doing with families and children is very, very commendable. And, you know, we in Jackson County are trying to copy you. But I did have a question, and maybe everyone who comes up to testify can address this concern, and it may not be something I should be concerned about. But in the past, our juvenile system was looked at as that the child coming out of the system was, in a sense, the slate was wiped clean, and, you know, we would hope this would be kind of one bad act or so forth on juvenile's record, and they get a fresh start. I'm just concerned that as we do all this reporting, we adults sometimes assume things of young people that and treat them accordingly. I mean, you see it in schools and so forth. Well, this is a bad apple, and even if you don't intentionally try to treat them that way, you do it, and that's my concern here.
Well, there's a possibility of that happening, and a balancing test needs to be applied internally by the school district and the juvenile authorities and as they review this information. But on the other hand, you have to balance it against the safety of the other students and the faculty and the administration in what this student has done either elsewhere or in your jurisdiction that you've been now made aware of. I represent the Bentley Pines School District, and I can remember one case where a family actually moved from California where their son had been expelled for bringing some sort of weapon to school. I think it was a firearm. And similar to Oregon, you're expelled when that happens, and so their recourse was, rather than going to alternate education, California was moved to another school district. And, of course, the records and the things that the school district received in California didn't say that. And fortunately, a few phone calls were made, and it was discovered what the situation was. But in this particular situation, there is a judgment factor, and we have to rely on the school administration and the teachers to apply that fairly. It does allow the disclosure of more information. There still are the protections of the federal act, things that the school district can't disclose. So those rights will be considered.
And I think it's significant that this goes both ways. It's not just a matter of juvenile departments and courts and DA notifying schools, but schools now, this gives schools the opening that is provided for under the federal act, but not currently under Oregon law.
Correct.
To to direct information the other way, and I'm mindful of that coming in this morning, hearing NPR report on the Colorado shooting and how one of the things that they're, you know, the part of the conversation now is what little information there was that was shared between the juvenile authorities and the school, and in fact the two kids who were the shooters in the Littleton case, how they had this recent involvement with juvenile courts, but the schools apparently being unaware of the nature of the activity and just not a good free flow of information, and how critical that could have been. And boy, I heard that, and I thought, geez, we're hearing this bill on the right day.
You might be labeled as that bad apple, but uh-huh. It's also designed to help the student who's in trouble, because there will be more attention focused on you, and if with some assistance, you know, you can overcome that reputation.
Thank you. Actually, I should have clarified. I have less problem with releasing the information to the school district. But the problem really is, and again, I have to say this in a way, I'm not trying to make a derogatory remark about law enforcement. But again, if you release, and law enforcement knows there are all these people who've been in the system out there, when another incident or crime happens, your first tendency is to go out and look. You do that with adults. Go out and look who's in your community who has committed similar crimes or so forth in the past. And perhaps, maybe indirectly or directly, make a connection. And the school district, I don't have quite as much of a problem with. I think there could be times when it was misused, but in general, it's the reporting it to the law enforcement. And again, I want to know the law enforcement needs to know that I'm very supportive of them also. But yeah.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Senator. I have two questions, and one is I have strong confidence in law enforcement's ability to keep records confidential when necessary, prevent hackers to coming into the system and that sort of thing. And they, for the most part, they do a very good job when an expungement order is issued after the child is 18, if the particular crime is of a nature that can be expunged from the record. I'm not sure that school districts have the wherewithal or that all school districts have protections from hackers into records and also into extremely confidential records, behavioral records. I do know that there's an overlay system in some school districts where there's kind of one kind of incident computer database, but beneath that is the records of the counselors and so forth, and they may not have a good security system on them. I'm also concerned about, in the event that an expungement order is issued, generally those orders are addressed to anybody who might have records of the criminal behavior, and the court can order anybody in law enforcement or in the DA's office or any courthouse personnel to destroy the records of the juvenile. But how will this work with schools?
I think first on the latter question on expungement, it would be important for the party moving for expungement to get an order to the school district so that they know that those records they receive from the juvenile authorities would be expunged. And I believe the school districts will comply with that order. As far as hackers and information that's put into computers, each district that I'm aware of has security to try to avoid that. It's probably not perfect, but that's true of any other information they have, from their financial information to the medical records to disciplinary things. But it used to be you'd go into a section in the administration office and they'd have these locked filing cabinets where employee evaluations, whatever that there were that had to be confidential, were kept, and two people had the keys. Al Fricke's here from the Ben Lapine School District. He might discuss on the student records whether, one, it's in the computer system right now, or how exactly they protect it. But they have to, because if they don't, they can open themselves up to civil liability if the information is improperly released. And usually that's a strong motivation to make sure it's kept as private as possible.
Thank you, Senator. Follow-up question. Have you had any dialogue with various school districts about their ability to respond to an expungement order?
No. And in my seven or eight years of general counsel to a school district, I have never been presented with an expungement order. And when I used to do criminal work and I take care of expungement orders, I never recall sending one to a school district. But most of the time it's because you're dealing at that time with an adult and you don't think about going back that far. Plus, you might run into the federal act, which wouldn't allow the release of the information anyway.
Something to think about.
Well, that is true, that the purpose for which this information may be used is very limited anyway, so it wouldn't be something that would be normally subject to release to just anybody coming in for generic requests for student records or grade records or something like that. Representative Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill Morissette, representative from Springfield. My first awareness of the FERPA bill, this bill that we have before us today, was at a pre-White House conference with individuals from the other cities that had experienced the same tragedy that we did in Springfield. And it was someone from the Attorney General's office who informed those of us from Oregon that, yes, indeed, there was a federal law that could be applied if we did have enabling legislation. In fact, I did have a bill very similar to this that didn't go very far, partly because this bill was coming along. I also visited the Bend Lapine School District last week and saw the Safe School Alliance program up close and feel that it is a could be a national model of how to deal with these kinds of problems in public schools, because you know, all of the bases are covered, all of the main players from the justice system are involved. In fact, all of the school districts in Deschutes County use the Safe School Alliance, and this piece of it allows that communication to take place, and I just totally support this and think it's essential, really, to be able to lay the groundwork for safe schools. We need to have that type of communication ability. So I urge your support. Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morissette, you know about the Child Link program that we've been trying to put together in Lane County.
Yes.
And some of the problems that have cropped up in the implementation of that program. Does this bill, do you see any problems similar to that in this bill?
No, the Child Link program in Lane County is to open up lines of communication between Services of Children and Families and other agencies to share information. That is kind of a wide open system, where this is a very closed system between the school district and the juvenile department, law enforcement, and to the point where they have to agree that the information is not to be used for anything other than dealing with the problem behavior. It can't be used in adjudication against a student, and it cannot be passed on to other agencies. This is a very specific closed loop.
So, if I may, either one of you has the ACLU weighed in on this legislation. Do they have a problem here?
No, they haven't, and of course they attend many of the committee meetings on the Senate side. I'm sure I would hear from them if there was an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think they feel comfortable. Ah, yes.
Card carrying. We're okay.
Yeah. I think they feel comfortable, too, because the federal legislation is still in place,
okay,
which provides specific protections.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. I was just having a conversation with somebody in the audience. It's my understanding, actually, that all of this information is accessible anyhow. This is just a way of disseminating the information, correct? I mean, this information isn't confidential as it is, right?
Well, I think some of it is. I'll let the sheriff from Deschutes County and the school administrator talk about it. If it's not confidential, there certainly is a great reluctance in passing the information along without some legislative policy safety.
I will say that as counsel to school districts myself, that this is certainly enough of a gray area where you have agencies on the one hand and schools on the other that are reluctant to share information.
I mean, the school, if the school called the agency, they would not share?
you have these, what are youth services teams, I know that we have in our area, and frankly, I think a lot of what they're doing is sort of in the gray area in terms of sharing information right now. I think this legitimizes that and gives you a place to go in the statute to say, yes, this is okay, because I know we have these going on. But I have been asked specific questions in some areas, and I think they're operating in some gray areas right now.
And there are situations where they're just told, no, I can't tell you that.
Or else they build in these convoluted kind of processes within the team where they talk about hypothetical information,
right.
Hypothetical people that everyone knows who they're talking about.
Wink twice.
That's right, yeah. So this just brings it out in the open, a sunshine bill. Okay, thank you very much, Senator. Good to see you down here. Okay. While we're here, we've got a couple folks on this bill who have traveled for more than 100 miles to get here. So I think next in order of protocol, let me bring them up while we've got this hearing going. Greg Brown and Alan Fricke. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Greg Brown. I'm the sheriff of Deschutes County.
Al. Good afternoon. My name is Al Fricke. I'm assistant superintendent of schools from the Ben Lapine School District.
We're both members of the Safe Schools Alliance, which you've heard about briefly. I want to give you a little recap on what the Safe Schools Alliance is. And the reason that the Safe Schools Alliance came together is that we strongly recognize that we owe our students, our teachers, and our visitors to our school districts a safe environment to be in. The Safe Schools Alliance was formed last summer. We got all law enforcement, all the school districts, the district attorney, the juvenile department, and the community justice department, and mental health together, and developed some policies on towards creating safer schools. Our policies very generally address what are we going to do if we have students that bring weapons to school. What are we going to do if students have made violent threats against individuals? What are we going to do if we have a series of behavioral problems that are raising awareness? We set down some policies and said that met with the students of the school districts and said, here's the rules that the school districts now are going to come under. And since the school year started, we've actually removed 52 students from the school. Many of those were arrested. They all committed some kind of a crime, but they were all removed. The procedure is they're taken to the Deschutes County Juvenile Detention Facility. And then from that point, the juvenile department takes the information that's available and makes a determination should that student undergo a psychological evaluation. About half of the students have undergone them. The other half, it's been determined that it wasn't necessary. And so they then go into the court procedure with the court and go from that point. We have two, at least from the law enforcement side, two immediate concerns that we're trying to address with this bill. And they revolve around the access, especially the fast access to records that we don't have right now. None of our officers have the ability to go into the school district office and say, show me what you have on this student that just committed an assault. Those records right now are confidential. They're protected records, and the school district cannot give them to us. In Deschutes County, we have a very active program where we have officers in the school. I have deputies in all three of the school districts right now, and those deputies oftentimes are aware of prior problems. But even with their relationship and the fact that they're employees of the school district in a sense, because they're being paid in many cases, they do not have access to records. They can't get them. One of the things I wanted to mention with our school resource deputies is one of the biggest priorities that our deputies do in the schools is, yes, they're uniformed and yes, they're armed, but it's not having an armed officer in the school to protect the school. We're working really hard on programs to provide early intervention with the youth. We know that about 96% of all the kids that are at school are really good kids, and it's that 4% we're working with. And with the combination of law enforcement and staff, we're working to identify youth at risk and youth that come out of at-risk homes. If you go back and look at most of our violent acts that have occurred here in the schools in the last 2 years, there was a lot of signs that could have been picked up. The bill that we have before you today very simply allows Oregon to comply with the federal rules, the FERPA, which has been talked about, and gives us immediate access. I started to mention two areas that we would use. One, the student, say, that commits a some kind of a serious assault. It helps our officers if they can look at the records and find out what other kind of behavior occurred and take that information. Second is certainly the student that comes to school with a weapon. Usually there's some kind of prior behavior before that happens. Again, that's helpful for mental health and juvenile department. Under present Oregon statutes, what we have to do is either locate the parents, which sometimes takes, you know, quite a bit of time in these kids, because the kids that we deal with are, again, the ones that come out of their at-risk homes. If the parents are willing to sign a waiver, we can get the records. If the parent isn't, and in some cases they aren't, then it becomes a court process, and we have a time limit where we need to start that psychological. And so that's the one of the main purposes of this bill. Al?
Thank you. Sheriff
Brown? Question here from Representative.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. So I take it that this bill is reciprocal. Law enforcement will give information to schools, and schools will give information to law enforcement about a child's behavior.
It's the district attorney that's going to provide the actual information. Maybe an example would be we have a student that transfers from a school in Western Oregon to a school in Central Oregon. Right now, there's a lot of times not a transfer of records because the school district doesn't have it. They're not aware of some of the crimes. Which is really some pretty important information. So the district attorney will release information to school districts, and the school districts will share it with other districts when the student moves on.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
Let me give a little explanation. In my county, we have a really good juvenile intake center. When a child comes within the purview of the police, any police agency in the county, they're taken to this reception center, and they're held up to 5 hours until the parents come and deal with a problem. And then and there an intervention is done and the child is put on a plan of assistance, and as is the family, adjudication goes forward, you know, the process, the ball gets rolling there. But then and there, there's an immediate consequence to that child for behavior. The weak link in the system is children who commit acts that are criminal, but they do it on the school district, on the school grounds, and the school decides to handle it informally. So my question to you, is there anything in this act, or in this bill, or in the federal act, that will facilitate flow of information both directions, both from law enforcement to the schools and from the schools to law enforcement?
Chair Shetley, Representative Lowe, I think I can address part of that question, and I think Mr. Furkey is going to have to address the other part of it. From a law enforcement standpoint, if we're, you know, at least in our county where we're heavily involved with the schools, and more agencies, law enforcement agencies are, this bill will certainly allow the school districts to interface with their school resource deputies or other officers and provide some of that information in making determinations of what should occur. Just in the exact example that you gave, in Deschutes County, when a crime is committed under the Safe Schools Alliance, the school district does not handle it internally. We have an absolute mandate that law enforcement gets involved, as does then the juvenile department and mental health. We've really raised a standard to protect the students at schools and really provide that early intervention to the youth that are having the problems. I think it'll help a little bit was part of my answer, but I'm going to ask Al to carry on with what the school district would do in a case where law enforcement is not involved.
Well, we've got 20 schools in the Bend and Lapine area, and I don't know of one of those schools that have ever not contacted a law enforcement agent when an adult on campus, wouldn't have to be an administrator, teacher, or anybody on campus, was aware that a crime had just been committed on campus. That's the first number that we dial. However, I know of no law in Oregon statute that requires a school district to do that.
Follow-up question. For example, a teacher finds a child with, I don't know what they call it these days, a bag full of marijuana, or a teacher sees a child tormenting a laboratory animal severely, injuring it or something like that, or a teacher sees or administrator sees a child involved in a fist fight, sometimes under the theory of local in locus parenti, they handle these things themselves rather than building up a file and helping law enforcement with this information to identify an at-risk child. So I see that as the weak link, and I'm wondering what we can do about it.
If you know.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Lowe, I guess my suggestion would be that one of the things we would like to see every school and every law enforcement agency in the state do is adopt a similar policy as the Safe Schools Alliance policy. I think that would go a long ways because that policy does recognize those situations, and we know that those early signs are the signs that lead to future, you know, problems, and so the intervention is important. And so we believe that that's exactly what we're doing in Deschutes County, but not everybody is there yet. And so I think there's actually a proposal to maybe take our alliances policy and maybe try to do something with it statewide, but I don't know where it's going to go in the legislature.
Mr. Fricke, do you want to go through your testimony? It's like you.
Sheriff Brown has covered much of what I wanted to say, plus the questions and answers have pretty well covered it. I would like to point out, though, what it is that you received. It's a two-page executive summary again, has been pretty well discussed just in presentation and answers, questions and answers. Also, you have a copy of a booklet that's called Sharing Information. This is out of the U.S. Department of Justice. Office of Justice Programs and Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and it's an analysis that is a guide to the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA, as it applies to public schools and participation in juvenile justice programs. I didn't know if you had copies of these. Senator Bryant took the last 25 I had on the other side, so and this is not copyrighted, by the way. So I want to make sure that you had those as a resource.
Thank you. Representative Williams, this is your alma mater. Did you understand what he was saying?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
sure.
It took.
I've always been a big fan.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Leonard is still here. Let me recess this hearing. We'll just kind of bounce back and forth here and invite Representative Leonard to bring his group back up, and we'll go back into our hearing on Senate Bill 846 and finish with that testimony.
Yes, you had a question.
Where we left it was with Representative Werbelow about to ask a question.
Okay. I'll leave you thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think this bill has great merit. I just want to clarify for the record, if you look on page 2, one of the situations that this does not apply to is C on line 29, any admission of criminal conduct. You are talking about prior criminal conduct also, are you not, prior, present? For example, if somebody told you in this peer counseling that they had murdered somebody 10 years ago, the confidentiality would not apply in that situation. That's what I thought. Yeah, clarify.
And Brian DeLastmith is going to come up after us and speak to that specific issue.
Okay. Who wants to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Portland Firefighters Association, and today I'm also speaking for the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I've been a firefighter for 22 years. I've been involved in my association for the last 12 years as a primary officer, and I deal in my job as a union representative. And my job with the Fire Bureau, I deal with firefighters with problems almost daily. And what we've done in the fire service is ignored the problem. If we have a critical incident, such as the problem we had out in Gresham with the cave-in, that situation should have had a critical stress debriefing, and we didn't. We left it up to the officers, and they decided that we didn't need it. Something like that should be automatic. Something like that deserves the attention of a specialist to come in and debrief those folks. And we're suffering today from the inaction of the Portland Fire Bureau, and not just them, but everyone in the fire service. Our philosophy was We have a kitchen table. We're a family. We'll discuss it. Well, I must say that we are a dysfunctional family because we ignore the problem. And as a result of that, 1995, we had a firefighter, after 18 years of service, commit suicide. I'm dealing with a firefighter right now who was lost in the building, ran out of air, was rescued by one firefighter. They ran out of air, and finally, by the grace of God, was rescued by a third firefighter and took them to safety. And we spent hours in the hyperbaric chamber. And you know what? He had no counseling, no debriefing, no nothing. And someone who may have had an alcohol problem escalated to the extent that he has now lost his job. This is a problem that we may not affect my generation of firefighters because the damage has been done. My hope is that passage of this bill and other bills we can look at to the next generation of firefighters and give them the support that my generation didn't have. I appreciate your support for this bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. King.
Chairman, my name is Robert King. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here before you today. I'm a police officer with the City of Portland. I've been a police officer for over 11 years. I worked primarily as a uniformed police officer and then worked as a full-time trainer, was on our SWAT team. I now work as the full-time employee assistance coordinator. We have about 75 people that are in the organization that are involved in peer support in different ways. And I coordinate their activity, activate them, and evaluate them. And one of the things that we recognize is that peer support plays a vital role in helping folks kind of in the initial stages to get some help, because we know that they'll talk to one another, they'll talk to trusted peers. So we provide them with some good training around critical incidents, active listening, problem solving, et cetera, how to make referrals. But one of the concerns has always been confidentiality. Can this be repeated or can it be disclosed? If I share things with you that are of a private, personal nature, is that subject to some kind of discovery at a later time? One of the things that we talk with people about is the natural healing process. We share this sort of with everybody in the organization. We say it over and over again in the hopes that they'll get it. That when we look at children, we see them consistently doing three things when they're hurt. They most of the time will cry. They call out in some way, and they'll always go to somebody, usually a mom or a dad, to connect and get better. When they do that and they get down from being held, they are done. They go play. They go back to being kids. But what we notice is over time that specifically adults, I know from my experience, police officers, firefighters, people in emergency service work, that we're less likely now to make the noise. It's not as common for us to go to somebody, and it's pretty unlikely that we're going to discharge until we can make that safe. And I know that this is true from my personal experience. I've been involved in two fatal shootings. I've had three partners over the last 11 years. Each one of them have also been in shootings. As the employee assistance coordinator, I'm responding consistently all hours of the day and night all across the city of Portland to critical incidents and traumatic incidents, personal crises that are happening. From my experience, I remember back in 1991, I stopped a car for just a traffic violation, and the people that were in the car had opened containers of beer, and they were going to receive citations, and I was going to drive away. Unbeknownst to me, the three occupants of the car had all been involved in armed robberies in the days previous to the stop. So they thought they were being stopped to be arrested for robbery. A person who was in the back seat of the car got out of the car, came at me, attacked me. It was at night, so before I was even aware that he was armed, he had the opportunity to stab me. In response to that, I pushed him away from me, and I subsequently shot him, and he fell and was mortally wounded from his injuries. And at the time, I was 28 years old, and that was the most significant critical incident or event that had happened in my life up to that point. And as investigators were arriving, when there's an officer-involved shooting, probably anywhere in the state or anywhere in this country, it's a very significant event, and it evokes the response by a lot of people. But one of the things we're told immediately is, don't talk. Don't talk to anybody. Don't talk about what happened. You're going to have to get an attorney. There'll be a lengthy investigative process. And what we find is that in the moments, you know, in the minutes and in the hours and the days that follow those events, that one of the things we really need to be able to do is talk about it at least
from an emotional standpoint for us to be able to heal from what's happened to us. You know, we're not going to shortchange the investigative process. We're going to go before a grand jury, and we're going to find consistently that there's no true bill because we acted appropriately. We were justified in our actions under the law. But what we need is we need now this, the protection of this law, to provide people who are out there doing this kind of work, both in fire and police and emergency service work, who, after something happens to them, they need to be able to sit down face-to-face with another person that they know and that they trust and begin to talk about what has just happened to them so that they can heal and get better for it. In my prepared statement, I've provided some information about a case that I thought was relevant for you to consider as you thought about this matter. It's a United States Supreme Court, Jaffe v. Redmond. It's a 96 case, and the case acknowledged the value of privileged communication, confidential communications that are protected statements between an officer and a therapist. The law at that time allowed for a privilege with a clinical psychologist, PhD level, but had not extended to a licensed professional counselor. This law amended that and allowed for that. The court reasoned that the entire community can suffer, I'm quoting now, if the police officer is not able to receive effective counseling and treatment after a traumatic incident, either because trained officers leave the profession prematurely, which we know if they don't get good help, they do, or because they stay, which unfortunately can happen also, and not having received treatment, remain on the job. So they really, I was impressed by the court that they recognized this, saw the value and the need for people to be able to speak about this. And just lastly, we know that as we do this work that we're going to be harmed. I mean, doing fire work and doing police work, we know that we're going to suffer injury, both physically and emotionally. We understand the danger, and that as public servants, that it doesn't weaken our resolution to do the work. We know that this is right, and we know that these are the kinds of things that must be done to ensure the safety of the community. However, we do ask for your help in providing for this protection so that we can do some important things for ourselves and other people that are important to us in our life, that we can be restored for ourselves and for our families and also for the communities that we're serving. So I just would really, I'm very hopeful as I come before you today that that you will, in fact, pass this legislation, and I thank you very much for your testimony.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This could go to any one of you. I appreciate you bringing this bill. We had a similar bill addressing confidentiality and counseling for lawyers, and it passed out of the House, and I'm not sure where it ended up in the Senate. I assume they passed it as well. And I think these are really important things, particularly in your line of business. There's a lot of stress in a lot of different occupations, and lawyers tend to, in their case, had a pretty good case as to why they needed the confidentiality. And I guess one of the things that they presented, which was the question I want to ask you, is the ability to have confidentiality, will that enhance your ability to bring people in? Because I think that was the problem for the lawyers. That was their case, was confidentiality as being not having it, or at least clearly stating it, was a barrier to getting people in. I mean, you may get the horse to water, but you may not get them to drink. That's a different problem. But I think if this is a serious barrier, which I think is what you're going to say it is, then it really, I think, helps make your case. The question is, is this seen as a barrier to getting your members into counseling in some way?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Edwards, we just completed in our employee assistance program on the police side a survey, kind of a customer service type survey. And consistently, the response that we got to a question asking whether there is anything that prevents police officers from using the employee assistance program, the consistent answer that we got for people who felt that there was something that would prevent them from using the program was confidentiality, that they just didn't feel that they had the safeguards for their confidentiality in place. And this will enable us to let them know exactly where they stand in terms of confidentiality.
Let me ask, if I may, do these sessions, counseling sessions or peer support sessions, occur one-on-one as well as in group sessions?
Mm-hmm.
And so the intent would be that I guess the privilege would extend to, if it's a group setting, then all the members of the group, so that anyone who spoke would know that their statement could not be disclosed by the other participants in the group, and by the same token, the other participants would know that they couldn't be compelled to testify. That's the intent of this, to testify or,
right,
to, or to give deposition or other discovery by virtue of that participation. Okay. And but I assume also then the privilege belongs to the person whose statement it is, so that if I'm participating and I've made the statement, I can waive that privilege if the circumstances would warrant that sometime down the road. I think I had Representative Lowe and then Walker.
Was there an A in Grossed? Oh, yep. Okay. I missed the part about doesn't cover criminal conduct on behalf of the... Not that I would particularly accuse law enforcement of any criminal conduct, but supposing there was some sort of an internal investigation and... So I got shot because we use New York City because everybody can pick on New York City. Somebody got shot because they were where they shouldn't have been or conducting business they ought not to have been conducting, and then they use this debriefing to download and get some shielding to frustrate an internal investigation by the police agency themselves. That's not going to happen here. There are protections in this.
Chair Shirley and Representative Lowe. There are protections around that issue. I think the first of which would be the integrity of the other people that would be involved in the debriefing process. More likely than not, officers who are committing criminal acts wouldn't be going into group settings to talk at all about them. To obtain protection, they're going to be quiet and hide, more likely than not. But in the event that that does happen, in the event that that does happen, there's a protection around that. There are safeguards around that. I think in my position as employee assistance coordinator that would be a part of my responsibility to be able to acknowledge and recognize that facts like that exist, and that, you know, we would take appropriate action to respond to that. We're not presenting this bill as a way for anybody to commit a criminal act or hide behind their criminality and obtain privilege. This is not a part of that, and that we would, we'd be very careful to ensure that that wouldn't be the case.
Follow-up question.
Yes, Chair. We also have Brian DeLasky.
Hi, Brian.
As well.
Brian's on the speak.
Related to this question.
Oh, you want to, okay.
For the record, Brian DeLasky, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I think a more direct answer to the question is if you look at line 18 under 7, it talks specifically about the issue that you're bringing forward, which is shielding. Nothing in this act shields an officer or the officers involved from any evidence that would otherwise come to light. So what you really have here is two parallel things. You have a peer support counseling session going on, and you would have an internal investigation going on, and all that information is going to the internal investigation. What we're talking about is just that peer support piece. So it's covered in subsection 7.
Thanks, Brian. One last question.
Yes.
Why don't we have an emergency clause on this? This should go into effect right away, in my opinion.
Perhaps because we didn't ask for one.
Good. Okay. Any other questions for the panel?
Oh, yeah, I have a question.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was along the lines of Chair Shirley, and I think I answered it by looking at the bill. In the peer support sessions, they can be either one-on-one or group, but the bill designates that it needs to be someone who has been designated by the agency to be a peer counselor, so it couldn't be one-on-one with just a buddy. That would not be privileged, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. The second thing I just wanted to comment on is that earlier this session in this committee, we heard the Fallen Officers Bill. I don't recall the bill number on it. And we had testimony about the high incidence of suicide with firefighters and police officers particularly. And I think that this bill is an excellent way to prevent that from happening to your comrades, which is certainly something we don't want to see happen. I do see in here, in subsection 8, it says the section does not apply to any threat of suicide or homicide. So if you're in a peer counseling session and someone indicates that they're suicidal, you will take action on that and move forward.
And I might add with Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, with police officers and firefighters, when they threaten something like that, it's more credible than most.
Right.
Fortunately, as Tom Chamberlain has said, we've experienced it. And so usually don't get a firefighter or police officer threatening suicide is the problem. That's the problem. We have to be very aware of signs, very subtle signs and changes in behavior, and serving to about what's going on.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate what you're doing here, and we should come along many years sooner.
Any other questions for the panel?
Can we have a bill like this for legislators?
I'm afraid that we just probably wouldn't get the same kind of support, Rip.
Or sympathy.
I won't say it. I'll withdraw. Go ahead, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question was raised about emergency clauses. Is that something you're interested in? Or?
Of course, I am a person that looks at reality, and, you know, we've been through the other body, now we're in this body, and all I'm thinking of is we have to go through the other body again if you amend it here.
Right.
And those kinds of things begin to make me nervous.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, why don't we dismiss this panel. Mr. DeLashmit, you can stay where you are, and also Liz Crothers.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, again, Brian DeLashmit, Oregon Council of Police Associations. With me is Liz Crothers, who's the president of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. My duty up here has been half fulfilled answering any questions you had. I know that Representative Werbelow talked specifically about line 29, omission of criminal conduct in the back page. I think we answered that. But the one thing that I wanted on that point before I turn it over to Liz, I wanted to make very clear is that what we're really not talking about there, however, is what normally happens after, for example, a police officer shooting, in which the police officer, in unwinding with a peer support group, would talk about, did I really see the gun, did I not see the gun, those kinds of things. So that's not admission of criminal activity. We're talking specifically about an admission of criminal activity in that section. So.
Thanks, Brian. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Liz Crothers. I'm a police officer, and I'm the president of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which is a statewide association that represents 3,000 rank-and-file officers from across the state. Obviously, we're here today in support of Senate Bill 846. You've already heard many testimonies regarding personal experience, and essentially I'm up here to give you my own. When I was a brand-new police officer and had 4 months on the street, I was involved in a shooting. It involved two bank robbers that we got in a long pursuit with. The bank robbers ended up holing up in a hotel on MLK Boulevard. And as we pulled up right on MLK Boulevard, the bank robbers bailed out of the second story window. And just as I was opening the door to my police car, trying to get out to go after the guys, they turned and fired several shots at me and the police car. Fortunately, I wasn't hit, so we continued to pursue them through the parking lot. Eventually, they crashed through the plate glass windows of Holiday Park Hospital, and we took them into custody. I can tell you from personal experience that after something like that happens, it is extremely traumatic, and the automatic, normal human response is to want to talk right away about what happened. That's something that our psychologists have taught us. It's something that I've experienced personally. It's something I see in other police officers when I respond to these incidents as an association representative. Unfortunately, as you've already heard, we're not allowed to talk about these incidents after they happen. And fortunately, in my department, we have a system in place where after we're involved in a traumatic incident, specifically a shooting, we are required to go see a psychologist before we come back to work. This is abnormal among law enforcement jurisdictions. This is very progressive, and I'm sure that there are not very many agencies across the state that have this. So fortunately we have that, but not everybody does. And in many instances, a peer support counseling session is the only thing that an officer might have access to at all as far as what can help them after an incident like this. We desperately need the opportunity to be able to debrief after these traumatic incidents without any fear that what we say might be used against us in court. And I'd like to emphasize here and make this real clear, this is not an attempt by the Oregon Council of Police Associations to hide anything that our members are doing. We still have to write reports, we still have to talk to detectives, we still have to talk to the DA's office, we still have to go to grand jury. We are not going to be hiding anything. We just want our emotional statements about our own emotional well-being kept personal. Thank you very much.
Representative Loeb.
I didn't think so. I just wanted to clearly state it on the record, protect the record.
Mr. Chair, we would request quick action on this bill. We think it's in proper form and ready to fly, and with respect to Vice Chair Williams or Representative Edwards' question about the emergency clause, I'd take the bill coming out of there today rather than it being amended with an emergency clause.
That's for delaying it. So, okay, thank you very much. Lori Brucker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lori Brucker, General Counsel, Oregon Newspapers. We testified on the other side because of some concerns we had with the original bill and just want to get on the record something that Representative Lowe alluded to with some concerns about shielding or potential unintended consequence of shielding with the original bill. And I had trouble checking off neutral because we, as any kind of citizen, I think, in Oregon, the newspaper people would support this and do support this as a concept and believe that the A. Engrossed version takes care of the concerns that we had. And just for the record, want to get on our understanding that 8B probably covers what we originally were concerned about, and that is that the original bill referred to not only the communications between counselee and counselor that obviously need to be kept confidential to be of any value, but also then allowed for oral and written communications that could be conveyed, and our concern that that could then, in connection to the arising out of language in another provision, could be used to shield. And we're hoping that 8B takes care of that issue when it says that other information is required to be reported by law, so that things that are automatic or are already part of the public record could then not be brought into this session to be shielded.
Okay, so the idea that, your point being that information that is otherwise required to be provided or reported doesn't become protected just because it comes up in the context of the situation we're talking about here.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. And our understanding in talking with the proponents was that it was exactly their intent, that would not be their intent, that those kind of records could be brought in, but we were concerned about our perception that there was a lack of specificity of the language. But the A. Engrossed, I think, takes care of that.
Thank you very much. Okay, does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 846 before we close it and go into the work session? Not, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 846.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend that we pass the engrossed version of Senate Bill 846 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 846 to the floor with, as amended, to the A. Engrossed Senate Bill 846 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, well, thank you for bringing the bill forward today and good testimony in the background of it. Let's go ahead and call the roll.
Representative
Edwards? Aye.
Representative
Edwards?
Aye.
Representative
Lowe? Excused. Representative Walker? Aye. Representative Williams? Aye. Representative Witt? Aye. Senate Bill 846, A. Engrossed, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And
Representative,
everybody will have
pile
a freak for us.
Let's all hold hands.
Let's sing kumbaya and hold hands over this one.
Let's see. Who Representative Edwards, Representative Lowe, and Representative Walker all volunteered for it?
Yeah, we did.
Yes, we did.
Chair?
What?
I have a point.
Let's flip a coin over this side.
Let's see. Let's let Representative Walker, I guess it's been a while since you've... Have you carried one lately?
No. But she has to promise no demonstrative devices on this one, would you please?
Okay. That concludes our work session on Senate Bill 846. Thank you very much. And let's go back into public hearing, return to the public hearing on Senate Bill 449. And let me bring up three at a time here just to... I think this rounds off the folks signed up to testify. Larry Oglesby, Timothy Travis, and Kathy Osborne. Why don't you all come on up together and
let you go in that order with Larry first.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Shirley, members of the committee. My name is Larry Oglesby, Director of the Marion County Juvenile Department, and here representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. We are in support of this bill. We worked on this bill in the Senate, including the amendments to the bill. We also introduced another piece of legislation in the House, House Bill 2263, which had a hearing last Friday in Education Committee and has been deferred in favor of this bill, which does a similar thing. Our initial interest in this bill was in the FERPA exception, which you've heard described earlier. The issue, I think, was pretty radically described. It's a question of schools being able to share information with others in the juvenile justice field, including juvenile departments, mental health workers, other counselors, other agencies, in order to meet the needs of kids who have not yet been adjudicated into the juvenile justice system. The federal law allows this kind of an exception, but requires a state law putting in place the exception, and then the schools can share the information. That, in a nutshell, is what this is intended to do. That is in Section 7 of the bill. The bill, as you see it, though, now goes well beyond that, incorporates a variety of other sections, which we're also supportive of, which is basically a reciprocal sharing of information back and forth between schools and others in the juvenile justice field. Section 8 of the bill deals with being able to share confidential social history information with school superintendents to further the interest of dealing with the best interests of children. And I would add that the other sharing in the first few sections of the bill dealing with information related to when a youth is arrested, charged, and convicted is basically information that is in addition to the monthly reports that juvenile departments currently provide by statute to schools about youth who are on probation. So we have a variety of mechanisms here to share information to allow everybody involved with these youths to basically do the best they can in terms of rehabilitation as well as protecting the community. So for those reasons, we're supportive of the bill, including in my testimony are several scenarios about how this would play out in terms of the information sharing. I won't go into those unless you have specific questions. We do have one concern about the bill, and it was an issue that we attempted to fix on the Senate side, and it didn't happen. It deals with Section 2 of the bill, and the last page of attached to my testimony is a proposed amendment, which we thought had was going to address the problem. Having had further discussion prior to the hearing today, we would like to have the opportunity to draft a similar but different amendment. The goal here was to get the responsibility for providing the information to the agency or persons who have the best access to the information and the best position to provide it. And so we need to try another shot at the amendment. But based with that one exception, we're here supporting the bill and would be happy to work in a work group to develop the amendment that would fix it for all purposes.
Well, Representative Wilson.
Yes, I mean, I have a question with regard to that. Did you run the amendment by the Senate committee and they just refused to hear it, or what was the situation with it?
Chair Shirley, Representative Walker, the work group came up with some agreements on what should happen, and when the amendment came out, it simply didn't get captured. That portion of it did not get captured. There were other adjustments that were. It was simply a question of an oversight. So it was not a matter of lack of agreement or on either the work committee or the senators.
Council tells me that Senator Bryant is okay in concept with the amendment. So.
All right, thank you.
I'm Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department. We were part of the work group that worked on this bill on the Senate side. And to clarify the last point, it was one of those situations where those famous words are spoken, we'll fix it on the other side. Let's get this bill out of here. And so that's how it got here with the amendment not done. I know this committee's never done anything like that.
It's been rumored, but
occasionally
it's a lot.
Other committees do. I just wanted to reiterate some points that were made earlier. Most of the information that is going from the court to the schools is currently public information. We're not really prying any new confidential information out. We're just packaging it, in essence, and sending it automatically. If the schools wanted to go to the juvenile court, they could find out almost everything here. The exception to that from the juvenile side is the stuff in here about the release of the youth from the OIA. That stuff is not currently public information. And the main part of my testimony was simply to say that the Judicial Department worked on the bill. We liked it. We urge you to support it, and we will work on the amendment with the work group.
Ms. Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. I was also a member of the work group. Juvenile Rights Project, although we worked on this, and I think it's a much better bill than it was in the beginning, is taking no position on this bill. But I want to explain that because of the concerns that were listed. Obviously, because of the incidents that happened at Thurston and Littleton and across the country with shootings in schools, there's a lot of concerns by the schools about getting information to make sure that the schools are safe. And Juvenile Rights Project certainly wants schools to be a safe place for kids to be. Our concern is that this information will be used to kind of target the bad kids and get them out of the school setting. And I suppose the only way that that can be seen is by putting this in practice and letting it will be up to the schools about whether they use this in an appropriate way or abuse it. Certainly we will be back here next session if we feel that the schools have been abusing this privilege of being at the table to try to deal with these kids that are at risk and are actually hurting the kids. But considering that education is a big part of trying to turn some of these at-risk kids around, I think it's very important for schools to be at the table. And for them to be at the table, they need to have the information available to them. So I guess this is kind of a jumping off the cliff with our eyes closed in some ways, hoping that the schools will come to the table to be of assistance rather than to be detriments in getting the kids out of the school. But we're hoping what will happen is when they get the information that these kids are at risk, since a lot of the times kids that are at risk are eligible for special education services but are not identified as being eligible for special education services, that may help spur the schools on to test these children and get them in appropriate educational programs, which will help them have success in school, which is one of the first indicators of getting at-risk kids out of delinquency and on the road to success. So although we're not taking a position on this, we're hoping that the schools will use this in a positive way.
Okay. My inclination then would be to close the public hearing in a minute, and we'll authorize you to work with council to get the amendments drawn and get that back to us before the end of the next week or so and take action on it then. Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to testify? If not, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 449, and Chair requests unanimous consent to return to work session on Senate Bill 846 for the purpose of allowing Representative Wells and Representative Wardlaw to cast their votes. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Wardlaw, how do you vote? Senate
yes.
Bill 846, yes?
Yes.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Time to close the work session and... I accidentally tapped the gavel. What do you need there, Representative Wells?
Well, I was thinking that Randy worked so hard on that bill that maybe I don't want to take a bill away from Vicki to carry on to the floor and
he didn't ask me for it.
He didn't ask for it.
No.
He can speak to it on the floor.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
That's nothing. Okay. We're adjourned. Don't fret.
I don't know. I don't know.